The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the weekly Dharma series.
Thank you all for showing up tonight. Have people, how was that working with rain? Anyone have any response to that practice? Feel free just to unmute and jump in.
I had done with a few other people at Common Ground Raindrop with Michelle McDonald. She's actually gone further with her training, and drop is like, you know, the other side of that. So I was familiar, you know, with rain and also with Tara's way of describing it. I found tonight that I took on something too big. And so at a certain point, with the kind of nurturing part, the end part, I like felt the most nurturing thing I could do is to pull out of it. Mm-hmm. And I look out, my computer is, I can look out and I see trees, skies, clouds. I've been trying to touch in a little bit to generational trauma, and I can only go somewhere near it. And I'm not sure if this is a story or if it's true. For me, I don't have a lot of feelings in my body. I feel pain, but otherwise I'm pretty numb. And so over the, you know, maybe past year, it's like I'll just kind of touch up to it. And I noted confusion, but it seemed the best way to take care of myself was to touch and then come out.
Mm-hmm. That sounds really, really skillful. I learned a term a couple of months ago I thought was very interesting that applies to what you said, Mary, and it's called resourcing. So and this is for people who do, it was doing some work with a white allies group around, it's called somatic experiencing. And so it's to work with our bodily responses to being white people and in a culture in which white is dominant and oppressive. And the leaders, the guides, talk about resourcing. So it's just what you did, Mira. It's that you, you know, you look out on trees. You have things around you often that are visual, auditory, sensory resources, so that when you start to feel overwhelmed, you can immediately tap out and touch some of those. That's a very skillful thing to do. And I was unfamiliar with this idea of resourcing, that you, when you're doing a difficult kind of work, to have things in your immediate environment that will provide comfort and stability. And also that just in a very sensory way that you can direct your vision. So thank you for sharing that. If the helicopters get too loud, someone can just, I don't know, can you hear the helicopters? Okay. We have a lot of helicopters these days. So this week we're going to talk about the parami of wisdom. And wisdom is, you know, these paramis kind of build on each other. We need to shut the window for the... We've had some military helicopters in the area. So wisdom is the ability to discern and to see deeply. And In Buddhism, the idea of wisdom is that it is essentially seated in the three characteristics of existence. It's understanding impermanence. In each of characteristics, it's understanding dukkha, which, you know, we often talk about as suffering, but etymologically, dukkha comes from the hub of a wheel not being in alignment with the axle. So etymologically, dukkha or suffering is being out of alignment. Or Santikaro, again, using that idea of the wheel, Santikaro talks about it as that which is hard to bear. Sometimes it's translated as dis-ease. So, you know, it's the unsatisfactory nature of conditioned experience. And then the other characteristic of experience, in addition to impermanence and dukkha, is anatta. And that is the not self, or that it's not that there's no self, it's that things are not self. Another way of looking at that is the impersonality of experience. You know, when you're out and it's a nice day and you're having, you're walking, and suddenly, you know, a storm blows up and, you know, it's like, why me? You know, that sort of tendency that we often have to center ourselves in all of our experiences. Why should this be happening to me now? Why is this, that everything is always kind of about me? So I like to think about this sort of not self characteristic in ways as just so much of our experience is impersonal. You know, that there's an earthquake, there's a storm, you know, someone gets hit by a car. So much experience is just, you know, you are in this place at this time, and there are these causes and conditions. And so wisdom, and that's not to say that we're never responsible for anything, but wisdom is really rooted in this appreciation that, you know, the ground is always moving. Change is always, always happening. And a lot of our suffering comes from our clinging to wanting things either to not be this way or to stay the same. You know, that there's so much of our suffering sort of at a micro level and a macro level is about really resisting change. And I mean, and the big one, of course, is that we're all going to die, right? That's the really hard one, that we are impermanent. And that's a challenge. Ruth King, a wonderful person who wrote Mindful of Race, she says all the time, everything is imperfect, impermanent, and impersonal. And that's kind of her mantra. She says, imperfect, impermanent, impersonal. And, you know, just to keep that as a sort of mantra, when we begin to look at wisdom, because wisdom is really going to be about the ability to discern, to choose right action, ultimately. But that understanding about choosing right action is really rooted in deeply understanding the way things are. The way things are is we are all impermanent. And we all suffer. And we all have things happen to us that just happen to us. And that's kind of the way the world is. Deeply, deeply impermanent. And once we can really get that and get how quickly things can change. You know, 2 weeks ago, I was mostly thinking about COVID-19 and, you know, isolation. What would the summer look like? What would the fall would like? Would I be on Zoom forever? Am I ever going to be able to get my hair cut? You know, that was sort of where I was, you know, a week ago. And, you know, I could not have imagined at that time that I would be, you know, patrolling my alleys looking to see if people had left incendiaries. You know, and I'd walk down to Common Ground every day with my heart in my throat to see if it was okay. And, you know, and my post office is gone. It is a shell and ashes. And the restaurant I love, it's a shell and ashes. The Walgreens is gone. You know, I would walk to Common Ground saying, all right, you know, this is a great teaching in impermanence and a great teaching in clinging. There's no, Mark kept saying over and over again, you know, it's a building. It's not Common Ground. It's a building. And so, you know, really rooting myself in that sort of impermanence and rooting myself in the incredible suffering that the communities of color have experienced in, you know, the incredible history of systemic racism in Minneapolis, and particularly the incredible racism in a lot of the Minneapolis police force. You know, that's another part of really rooting myself. And there's just so much suffering going on, and now more suffering. And not taking it personally, you know, I think about, you know, my Walgreens, my post office, and the, you know, the jobs, the lovely people I would interact with who worked there. And I think, okay, that's gone. That's really gone. And that's really seeing how things are. So the task of wisdom is to really see how things are. And on that basis, we choose to act. So you can ask yourself, what do I see clearly in this situation? Even if it's just your own, say, response to watching the news or watching a Facebook feed or something. What do I see clearly in this situation? Because so often, I mean, it's my experience, if I'm not really paying attention, I just kind of absorb and move with it, move with my opinion. I have to have an opinion about what I just saw. I have to have a view about what I just saw. Instead of, can I look, what do I see clearly in this situation? What do I see clearly? And not only about sort of seeing externally, but seeing internally. What do I see clearly about my own reactivity in this moment? What's my own reactivity like? What am I clinging to? So then the next question, which comes out of this, is, you know, what's causing my suffering right now? And what I've noticed in my reflections this week have been, there's a lot of I in what's causing the suffering. I mean, it's really easy for me to kind of move to, you know, sort of reflections about what I won't have now, that, you know, I won't get to talk to that nice person at the post office or the nice pharmacist at Walgreens. You know, I won't get to go to the library for, you know, there's the suffering is about sort of my story about the future that I'm not going to have, as opposed to, you know, sort of doing something that might be more constructive. And it's not that I don't want to say that there's not a place for grief, because grief is really important. So I'm not minimizing real grief and real loss. But what I am seeing in myself are, when I stop to pay attention, there are these stories about this sort of future pleasures that I'm not going to have. And also, I've been looking at what am I identified with? And I've been identified in partly with performing, being a good white person, you know, wanting to be seen as a good white person. And that's just something to just watch that tendency. But, you know, to do the right thing, where do I show up? How do I show up? You know, just sort of watching a lot of performative acts on Facebook, in a way. And, you know, some very, very skillful, but just really, really watching, trying to really discern what is the action that will be beneficial to myself and beneficial to others. You know, there's a story they have in Zen circles that they say, you know, what is the ultimate teaching? And the answer is appropriate response. And that's really challenging. So throughout these, especially as I think, as we work with anxiety, one of the interesting questions I think is, what is my understanding? And is my understanding a misunderstanding? And just to go into that as a kind of open question. What is my understanding of this situation right now? And, you know, wisely choosing the right action depends on knowledge and experience and understanding. And one of the interesting books I read this past year that really had a big effect on me is a book by a guy named, he died in 2018. He's been a longtime public health hero of mine, Hans Rosling. And he wrote a book called Factfulness. And I think the subtitle is Why Things Aren't As Bad As You Think They Might Be, which for many people who are really hard-headed just seems like, well, I'm not going to read this book. But, you know, one of the things that Hans Rosling said is, if you ever get a single statistic, it tells you nothing. If someone tells you that, you know, 4 million babies died of preventable diseases this year, that's really not a useful statistic. What you need to know are, what were the statistics the year before and 5 years before and 10 years before? That statistics only make sense in comparison. It's a really interesting book that really brought my attention to how quickly I form an opinion without all the facts. And when we talk about wanting to choose wisely, to act wisely, it's really important for us to have some really good knowledge. And sometimes it's scientific knowledge, knowing basics about biology. Although I'm laughing now because I'm remembering the New Yorker had a great cartoon about a month and a half ago. And there's a guy sitting at a computer and he's telling his female partner who's in there, and he says, "This is amazing," he said, you know. 3 months ago, all my friends were constitutional experts. And now they're all experts on epidemiology. And I thought, yeah, you know, having opinions about things that we don't really know. So wise action, acting with wisdom, especially in the, you know, when we try to bring our mindfulness into the world, into our action. Part of it is really we need to have knowledge, and we need to be careful about that, the facts of a situation, you know, which might mean, like, for example, here in Minneapolis, knowing the history of racism, you know, knowing about redlining, you know, there's so much. There's a wonderful documentary called 13th, which is about the 13th Amendment, which is the, you know, history of, you know, the carceral state, our incarceration. The book, The New Jim Crow, which was just a book that was just tremendously painful to read. And a lot of it is about policing and the legal system. And those are books that just really, The New Jim Crow particularly, just was like a scouring. It was really hard to read. And I think if I had not been in a book group at Common Ground that was reading it, or I had an assignment, I just probably would have put it down and maybe not finished it because it was so hard. So I think, you know, when we look at something like this, what's going on right now, it is really important to have some understanding, some real knowledge. And then we need to have experience. And sometimes it's our own experience. We bring that to the table. But sometimes our own experience isn't enough, which is why it's really important for us to listen deeply to other people and their experience, people who don't come from the same frameworks that we come from. And, you know, that looking at so knowledge and experience. And I've really found as I get older, I trust my own intimations that something isn't right. That I've gotten to trust my own hesitancy a lot more. And I think that's really kept me from sort of blundering on about things. And I think this just doesn't seem right. And so I think that we really need to trust our experience. And finally, understanding, our own understanding what we want to. And it's, you know, in there are the five daily reflections that I think are really helpful to me, that every day I say to myself, I'm growing old. Illness and infirmity await me. My death approaches daily. All that is dear and delightful to me will be separated from me. And that I am the inheritor of my past karma, the owner of my present karma, and the fabricator of my future karma. And the reason that's so helpful is to really take responsibility for what I'm doing. And I'll also say, as a parent, you know, I can say every day, illness and infirmity await me. And then something goes wrong and, you know, I'm just sort of gobsmacked. But I'm such a healthy person. How could I get sick? So I don't want to say that this is sort of, there's anything magical about it, or that I'm the perfect exemplar of this. But it's really helpful just to remind myself every day that, you know, my death approaches daily. And that really does help us make wiser choices. That really does help us get to the heart of this. That when we think that our when we're reminded of our own mortality, we don't take important things so lightly. We really step up to the need to be discerning and to act when it is appropriate. And that really is all about this wise discernment. Wisdom is this investigative ability that we have. It is a virtue of investigation. And it's one that we really, really need now when it is a time when we are just inundated by views and opinions. And so it's a wonderful practice. So I'm going to leave it at that for now and hear what you have to say about the way you've worked with wisdom or making choices or what you are thinking about or what's really challenging about this. So just unmute yourself and join in.
Like everyone, I'm sure, when all this started last week, for me, I was just observing my state of being, my emotions. I found myself getting so worked up and going, oh my God, I'm not practicing what compassion is about, because I was beyond empathetic. Every time I mean, aside from the fact that George was killed, which is horrific in itself, and historically I have experienced heavy duty racism and major violence and demonstrations back when I was 16 years old growing up in Cleveland, Ohio. And my dad was a cop at that time, but that's a whole other story. I'm just going to focus on this week because I had an entire other story of what played out for me as a 16-year-old back then. So that in itself was so painful to witness George being killed and murdered. And then the past week, every time I would hear about another small business or even large business being burned down, it was just, I was just like, oh my God, this is so much. And asking Cindy, my partner, how can I, she would say, you know, you can't, you're circling the drain. So a couple of days ago, I got Sharon Salzberg's Loving Kindness book and I thought, okay, I just need a really basics with this compassion practice, this Brahma Vihara, because I had been doing metta. And and Sharon says, you know, what you do in a difficult situation or group of people is with compassion, you first give compassion to the most horrific situation. And then you can move through, like in metta, where you first do it to mm-hmm. yourself, you know, and so forth. And that helped me out tremendously. That and not glued to the news to see, okay, is there another business that burned down or whatever. So I took her words to bed with me at night, and what came up for me was sending compassion practice, really focusing in on those people that were creating that violence and burning businesses down, and just sending them compassion, saying, may you not see, I'm finding myself as I go into this, you know, how may you be at peace. May you be free from suffering. May you be at peace. May you be free from suffering. This went on for a long time before I could even get to myself. I found the last several days just doing that practice. Because I found that the other way was not a form of really compassion. It was just coming from a place of many other emotions.
Mm-hmm.
So that helped me not be circling the emotional drain. That and being with nature. Like today, I just took my bicycle and I just rode and rode and rode. And anytime I would think of any kind of potential violence, would just, may these people be at peace. May they not have suffering. And that's all I could do. I hardly could get through any of the other steps with a compassion piece. And Sharon says with compassion to keep it very simple, the phrases. Maybe one, maybe two phrases. So that helped. So that's what I did.
That's really, really wise.
Yeah, this, I've been struggling with wisdom. Like this morning I got called out right off the bat, where I had been on a phone with a friend of mine that lives just a couple blocks from Ground Zero, where they have the memorial, and she was telling me how she, you know, got up every morning at 6 and went down to the memorial and cleaned up everything, and they would deliver the donuts, and you know, Kevin, you have to come down here and see it. And and then I talked to a kind of my meditation mentor at Common Ground, called me a little bit later, and I was telling him, you know, yeah, they say that, you know, I heard, you know, from several people the protesters are peaceful, you know, who are these guys? And you know, kind of rambled around a little bit, and he said, Kevin, you don't know any of that. I mean, you're just hearing secondhand knowledge, you know, you're hearing what you want to hear. You're hearing what other people are telling you, but you haven't seen this. You haven't. So it just kind of, caught me right. You know, it's like I got caught right there. That yeah, I just kind of jumped to some conclusions, and kind of Common Ground's important to me, and it's mostly the practice. I'm a white boy from the suburbs. I was born and raised around white people. When they taught race relations in high school, they had to bring a couple people in from a different city, you know, black people, to talk about what it was like to be a black person in a city. And so when I go to Common Ground, there's, you know, a lot of talk about the Dharma, and there's a lot of talk about, you know, this other issue, which I know you can't separate it from, you know, the issue of racism, you know, that comes up there. But it's just, you know, the firsthand knowledge. You know, I don't have, you know, I've been living in neighborhoods, you know, racially mixed neighborhoods, and I know when I see a black person on the street, you know, my first inclination is always just, you know, to be friendly, like, you know, you're with everybody, to smile and say hi and, you know, give just the standard greeting. But I know that if the person is, you know, somebody white, like I understand, you know, I can pretty much read their face and see if they're angry and, you know, what kind of a mood they're in. Are they a threat to me? You know, are they drunk? Are they on drugs? You know, and with people of a different race, you know, I can't recognize their, it takes me a while to process, you know, their body language. And so I know there's, you know, some, you know, I can't understand their experience, and there's a little bit of lag there that I'm not comfortable. So anyway, I was just amazed, you know, how quickly I was able to forget what I've been trying to learn, and, jump off to a conclusion because it's a friend of mine's information that a friend of mine gave me, you know, that it's from a certain point of view. And I have friends, you know, that are Trump supporters too. Well, they used to be friends. I'm not nearly as tolerant as them as I used to be, you know, relatives that you can't do anything with. So.
Well, thanks. One of the things I think I've mentioned with this group that my, one of the things I was going to practice with this year was this idea of making space for not knowing that, and it wasn't just like allowing that, it's like really making space for not knowing. So I've been holding these two kinds of ideas. One is making space for not knowing. And as I've heard all of these reports about who's doing what and what's happening, and I don't really know that. I don't know if anyone really knows that. But then there's also, on the other hand, this responsibility to be as informed as we can be in efforts where it's important. So, you know, I think that that's sort of what you're suggesting is this honest admission of not knowing, and then the next step is to figure out, well, how to know more. And when you talked about reading body language and faces, actually, there's been some new data that's come out that, you know, people used to think that there were the same expressions for fear, anger, disgust, and they were just, you know, universal. And there was actually some social science done more recently that says, actually, that's not the case, that the older studies were really flawed, and that, you know, in Papua New Guinea, when they see pictures of, you know, people showing disgust or anger, they read those very differently. So one issue, sort of a larger issue of why sometimes it may be difficult across various cultures, and they're talking mostly internationally, for people to really understand each other, is that people do have different cultural facial expressions and body expression, and especially around issues of fear, anger, and disgust, which are sometimes harder to tease out. So that's not, you know, we always thought that these were sort of universal and transparent, but more recent data suggests that they're not. But I think your other point is just, you know, coming from one sort of limited milieu, you know, what you can do then to really educate yourself and to learn more, to really support your understanding, would be a really good thing. So thanks for sharing that. And it is really important for us to say, do I really know that? You know, that first question I asked, you know, what am I seeing clearly? So who else would like to contribute something?
Hi, everyone. Jim, my heart's with all of you. First, I wanted to be in Minneapolis to be safe because I'm in Boston. And then everything shifted. And now I just want to be in Minneapolis to be with you.
Oh, you're here with us tonight.
Every day I speak to somebody and, you know, I don't know if you've had the experience of haven't talked to family in a while or something and some relative dies and somebody forgot to tell you and then in passing they just mentioned, you know. So almost every day I talk to somebody and in passing they mention, like Hamsa was saying, another place that's no longer. And it's like I've lost it. Just a loss. And when I left in March, I never, in a million years, how would I ever have thought that the Minneapolis I left would not be there the way I left it when I came back next time. And I've been thinking of this in terms of people and permanence, that when I engage in conversation with people, sometimes, you know, the It's hard. That's a challenging area of Dharma for me, of staying mindful in dialogue or in relation with someone else. I know a lot of people say that, and I lose my mindfulness or I get lost. And sometimes I say goodbye and I'm not even aware what's going on when I'm saying goodbye. I've been thinking about that. Can I be present and look at the person like with impermanence in mind at the beginning, during, and at the end? Am I taking that person, like right now, am I taking you all in with the notion of, yeah, maybe this is the last time? And it's not a morbid reflection, the way that reflections, you know, they're not intended to be morbid, but they do wake me up, you know, like, so I was thinking that you gave last night in the other group, Patrice, about the teaching to Rahula about action, mm-hmm. you know, reflecting before, during, and afterward. And I'm thinking of that with interacting with people. And then what you just said about the different cultural, you know, I used to work in the public schools in Brooklyn, New York, and then in Boston, and as a mental health provider, not as a school personnel. And the teachers are predominantly here in Boston, predominantly white, and the children were predominantly African American, mostly Black. And one of the things that would happen over and over was like issues around disrespect and authority. And young boys in particular who had been trained to avert gaze when a person of authority was addressing them. So they looked down. And so many times I would walk by and there would be a big white teacher, and this is elementary school, and a small Black child. And the child would be, you could see, respectful in their mind, looking away, looking down. And the teacher would be, look at me when I talk to you. Look me in the eye when I talk to you. How disrespect, you know, and the heartbreak of seeing that, you know, karmic collision right there, just, mm-hmm. you know, that was many years ago. Hopefully some of that's changed, but I envision in some of these situations, we're talking about, you know, spontaneous reading people's cues and attributions. Like you said, what am I seeing before me versus what am I adding to that? Like, what mm-hmm. am I projecting in terms of my own understanding? So I don't think I'm seeing anything clearly. I'm just feeling there's just a lot of not clear. That's what's before me.
And that's a good thing to recognize. That's mindfulness, recognizing when you are not clear, things are not clear, and being allowing that. Being okay with that, not rushing to some sort of resolution. That idea, having to know what is the right thing. Years ago, I knew someone who was a social worker who said, that whenever she had to make a decision, she would just mull it over. And she said, eventually she would get to make a decision, but she took forever. And she said, I'm just waiting for things to get clear. And was very skillful in making decisions. But, I know my own personality is much more about, let's get this done. I'm on a timeline. Let's get this done. And having the patience to sit with things being unclear, which is why I talked about sort of making space for not knowing. I thought that was a really good corrective for me this year, to sit with that. So our time is up. Does anyone want to say anything before we close out? I really appreciate everyone being here tonight, and just feel the importance of us coming together to talk about developing these qualities of the heart that help us to live with integrity, and qualities of the heart so that we don't harm ourselves and that we don't harm others. So really taking the nobility of that aspiration to the heart. It is a noble aspiration
to practice developing these qualities of all qualities of non-harming. So thank you all, and I hope to see you next week. Take care.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.